The briefing is brought to you in association with the Sustainable Cities in Action Forum at Expo City Dubai. The Sustainable Cities in Action Forum at Expo City Dubai is a place for city leaders, developers, architects and designers to come together and innovate for the future of urban spaces. It's an opportunity for the Global South to convene in the Global South. It's a testbed for real-world solutions that will shape the future of people and planet. You can hear from the innovative thinkers and inspirational voices that drove the narrative at this year's edition by listening to Monocle's special episodes of The Briefing, recorded live at Expo City Dubai in March. Find and listen to the shows now at monocle.com or wherever you get your podcasts. The Sustainable Cities in Action Forum 2024. Collaborate, innovate, transform.
You're listening to The Briefing, first broadcast on the 6th of December 2021 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to The Briefing. We are live from Monocle's newsroom at Dufourstrasse 90 in Zurich. I'm Chris Chermak. Coming up on today's show, Myanmar's government in exile condemns the sentencing of the country's former leader, Aung San Suu Kyi.
This verdict has nothing to do with the rule of law, but has everything to do with the prolonging of military rules, a reign of terror against the people of Myanmar.
Also up ahead, we'll be exploring whether Joe Biden will be using the carrot or stick approach to stop Moscow from antagonizing Ukraine.
What I am doing is putting together the most comprehensive and meaningful set of initiatives to make it very, very difficult for Mr. Putin to go ahead and do what people are worried he may do.
Then we'll have the latest business headlines from Bloomberg, and David Phelan is here to tell us about the tech goodies that are on the market just in time for Christmas. All that is right here on The Briefing with me, Chris Chermak. Myanmar will be feeling a sad case of déjà vu today. Aung San Suu Kyi had long been one of the world's most prominent political prisoners, but all that changed in the last decade as she was released and helped usher in something of a democratic transition in the country. All that progress was then reversed in a military coup in February, and today the now 76-year-old Suu Kyi has once again been sentenced to 4 years in prison. It's the first in a series of verdicts that could see her jailed for life. She was found guilty on charges of inciting dissent and breaking COVID rules. She faces 11 charges in total, all of which have been condemned as politically motivated. Now let's get the latest on this with Ronan Lee. He's a visiting scholar at Queen Mary University of London's International State Crime Initiative. He's also the author of the book Myanmar's Rohingya Genocide. Ronan, let's just start with, it's not surprising after what we've seen in this last year that this regime does not tolerate dissent, but why the verdict now?
Well, they were never going to let Aung San Suu Kyi out of jail. They were always going to keep her in. What's more serious about this time than maybe the time during the 90s and the 2000s, when she, of course, spent 15 years under house arrest, is that back then they kept her under house arrest because they maintained she was a risk to public stability, that she was destabilizing the politics of the country. And as a result, they were keeping her away from the politics. This time, they've decided to label her a criminal. And that's a big deal, because that's an indication from Myanmar's military that they're not prepared and won't be prepared to consider any sort of compromise with the opposition into the future. It should be remembered that even when she was under house arrest in a previous iteration of military rule, there were always occasional conversations between the authorities and Aung San Suu Kyi. And ultimately, that led to the compromises that made by the military and compromises made by Aung San Suu Kyi that gave us the 5 years of a quasi-civilian democratic rule within Myanmar. This time, It's looking like the hardliners in the military are fully in control. They're not going to be prepared to consider any dialogue with Aung San Suu Kyi or the opposition, and that's what's been clearly signaled. And they're not going to soften their stance in the future. So what we're going to see in Myanmar is either the will of the people, and the people don't want the military in power, or we're going to see the military winning. There won't be a compromise. And that means that the civil war conditions that are existing within Myanmar at the moment will continue till one side definitively wins.
Well, let's back up a little bit on that then. And you talked about the compromise that did exist for a while. I mean, I guess the question still is, what changed? Did the hardliners simply take over in the military, or was it something about the civilian process that they just did not like and feel was a failed experiment, at least in the military's eyes? I mean, what changed that we're back at this point that she is now labeled a criminal, as you say?
Well, certainly the hardliners are in control. I mean, there's no question General Min Aung Hlaing, the coup leader, is one of the hardest of the hardliners within the military. I think there was a sense in the military at one point that their future could be assured if they compromised with the impetus for democratic rule within Myanmar, and that they could maintain, as they did through through a military drafted constitution, that they could maintain significant political power. And I mean, the military, there was no civilian oversight of the military. The military were granted 25% of the seats in the parliament and ministries designated just for them. I think they felt, though, that Aung San Suu Kyi's government was wanting to push beyond that, and that unnerved them. And that's, I think, really why we saw the coup. I think the military expected that their proxy party would receive a much stronger share of the vote than it did at the election that was held last November. I mean, the reality in Myanmar is that the people don't want the military in control, so they don't want to vote for the military's party. The military, though, don't really understand that. The senior figures within the military they live in a world that's very separated from ordinary people and from ordinary values. Their soldiers at lower ranks are separated from the community, and they're really spoon-fed the idea that the military are the only people that can really control the country and maintain its sovereignty. And I think the election of last year really shocked them, and I think it was an indication. I think they took that as an indication that democracy couldn't be trusted. They've maintained that the election was in some way rigged, which independent observers would be very clear in saying it simply wasn't. And that's why they're indicating that they won't be compromising with the people of Myanmar who want a democratic future.
So if they're not going to be compromising, as you say, and democracy has failed in their eyes, is there anything that they hope for from Aung San Suu Kyi? I mean, she's not necessarily going to, you know, change her mind or speak out from prison in favor of the regime or anything like that. Is it just a signal of sending her to prison, or do they hope that somehow they will reach some kind of peaceable accord, or are they just going to continue to crack down as hard as they possibly can on Aung San Suu Kyi and the opposition in exile?
Well, that's exactly what they're going to do. They don't expect to reach a peaceable accord. They expect people to just give up. And that's what they're presenting to the people, that it's the military's view is that their success is a fait accompli, and that those who oppose them should just give up and walk away. Now, the military's approach to trying to, these are not people who believe in convincing people. The military's approach to changing people's minds has been to shoot them. They've murdered over 1,300 peaceful protesters since February. They've locked up 10,000 people, 10,000 new political prisoners created in Myanmar since February. This is not a military that's interested in dialogue or compromise. Their expectation is that opposition will eventually go away. And they've been surprised, I think, that there is such strong opposition to military rule. But the people of Myanmar are really clear. They don't want the military in power. There's a civil war underway. There are protests daily within Myanmar. We saw an active protest, videos of an active protest on Sunday, where people took to the streets of Yangon to protest against the coup. The military's response was to drive motor vehicles at the protesters. like an ISIS-style response to peaceful protesters, to literally mow them down and to indicate to those that support democracy that the military has no interest in listening to them and doesn't regard their concerns to be valid. I mean, this will either be won by the military or it'll be won by those who support democracy, but there will not be a compromise between the two.
Well, then just finally, Ronan, very, very quickly, is there anything that regional powers outside of Myanmar can do to swing this in the favor of those pro-democracy demonstrators?
There definitely is. An arms embargo needs to be enforced because the military are still able to purchase arms, and tighter economic sanctions because the military, particularly through gas revenues, is still receiving money from foreign sources. And as a result, they can fund the repression of the people of Myanmar. They would be two steps that the international community could take immediately, and I think would tip the balance in favor of those who support democracy and freedom.
Well, we'll see if that happens going forward. Thanks very much, Ronan. That was the Myanmar expert, Ronan Lee. Now here's Monocle's Paige Reynolds with the day's other news headlines.
Thanks very much, Chris. The US President Joe Biden has led tributes to the veteran Republican Bob Dole, who has died at the age of 98. President Biden said Mr. Dole was a dear friend and an American statesman like few in our history. Dole was a longtime senator who ran as the Republican Party's presidential nominee in 1996. The far-right French presidential candidate Eric Zemmour has been attacked at his first campaign rally. The 63-year-old was grabbed by the neck as he moved through the crowds to the stage. French media reports that Zemmour injured one of his wrists and has been ordered to rest by doctors. One of the creators of the Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine, Professor Sarah Gilbert, has warned that future pandemics could be more lethal than the current COVID crisis. Professor Gilbert, who delivered the lecture in Oxford, also said that there also needed to be more funding for pandemic preparedness. And today's Monocle Minute reports that Laos has opened a $6 billion high-speed railway. The line, which stretches for more than 400 kilometres, has been constructed as part of China's Belt and Road Initiative, and you can find out much more about it at monocle.com/minute. Those are the day's headlines. Back to you, Chris.
Thanks very much, Paige. Now over to Ukraine, which remains locked in a tense standoff with Russia, which has reportedly amassed some 100,000 troops at the country's border. Does Russia really plan to invade, or are they showing a bit of military might to reach a more favorable deal? Well, we might find out a bit more tomorrow when U.S. President Joe Biden and his Russian counterpart, Vladimir Putin, are expected to hold a video call in a bid to resolve the standoff over Ukraine. It follows a lack of progress at recent talks between the country's foreign ministers in the Swedish capital, Stockholm. Let's get the latest now on this with Emily Izawaho. He's program coordinator for peace mediation at ETH Zurich. He joins me here in the studio in Zurich. Thanks for coming in, first of all, Emily. And I mean, before we get to Putin and Biden, which will be happening by a video call, what was your takeaway from the talks in Stockholm that failed last week? Why Stockholm for one thing, and was there anything gleaned from that?
Good afternoon, Chris. Happy to be here. So a few takeaways. I think, first of all, to start with the question of why Sweden, I think it's a twofold answer. So one is the practical and more kind of logistical question of the OSCE, or the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, having held its Council of Ministers meeting in Stockholm, with Sweden being the rotating chair of the organization. So it was kind of stars aligned. But of course, it's not always the case that Russia and the US would send such high-level representatives to these meetings. So that brings me to the second point on why Sweden. So I think if you look at past high-level meetings between Russia and the US, they've often taken place in relatively small countries, say Switzerland, Finland, that are quite non-threatening from the perspective of Moscow or Washington, and very conveniently also non-NATO members. So that, of course, applies to Sweden as well. In terms of key takeaways, I think tensions being high is the key takeaway. And a lot needs to be seen tomorrow, what comes out of the video call.
Well, and in terms of the video call we're going to see then tomorrow, I mean, how would you, I suppose, advise Joe Biden if you were in that position? I mean, What can he do? Or do you also think they need more of a third party to mediate? How much are they going to be able to achieve just between the two of them?
So I think Biden will be really between a rock and a hard place in this cause. On the one side, he needs to be tough and show that he's being tough. There's a lot of domestic pressure as well within the United States, be it among the Democrats, but also among the Republicans, to be tough when it comes to sanctions on Russia, on cybersecurity, elections interference, treatment of opposition members. So he needs to show that he's being tough. At the same time, having said that, if you look at the U.S.-Russia relations, it's a broad cooperation, and that's not always so cooperative. But look at Iran, look at countries like CAR, Syria, Libya, other bilateral diplomatic missions issues. Again, if you start disaggregating, moving beyond Ukraine, you don't want to burn bridges too much, and then you need to continue dialogue and cooperation on some areas, even if you need to be tough, say, on Ukraine at the moment.
Well, if that's the case, and as you say, that there are so many issues happening between the U.S. and Russia right now. But then again, this specific call should be arguably focused on Ukraine, or there is a real crisis at the border in Ukraine. I guess then, to your point, how serious is this crisis? Do you actually expect some form of military invasion? Or is it more almost the way you're describing, that this is Vladimir Putin trying to get a conversation out of this on the whole host of issues that he needs to discuss with Joe Biden?
I think you can argue both ways. So on, yes, you need to take this threat seriously, and this kind of military brinkmanship performed by Russia has to be taken seriously. You're talking about hundreds of thousands of troops along the border and serious military equipment. So you have to take it seriously. And if you compare it with April of this year, Russia has been a bit more discreet about it, whereas in April they were very openly talking about the military exercise. So that could be some cause for concern in terms of what the true intentions are. Having said that, however, I would say this hasn't been this broad public campaign in Russia to kind of campaign for an all-out boots-on-the-ground war with Ukraine. So I think that's perhaps a signal of this being an unlikely scenario that Russia would indeed invade Ukraine. And at the same time, if anything, I would view this as an invitation to talk and in a form of signaling vis-a-vis the West and also Ukraine on this particular crisis on the part of Russia.
Well, in that case, then, let's flip it around. I'd be curious, because then some of the warnings about an invasion, you could say, have come from the Ukraine or from the U.S. for that matter as well, saying that an invasion is imminent. And as you say, Russia itself has maybe actually not sort of forwarded that that idea quite as much. I mean, what does Ukraine then perhaps want? Are they hopeful that a peace process can resume, that there can be some progress made on the peace process if they also bring sort of this international awareness back to bear right now?
So perceptions matter. And then if you speak to different sides of the conflict, as it were, you could talk about different levels of conflict. So you have the formal peace efforts under the auspices of the OSCE, and there Russia is in a way forced to have bilateral discussions with Ukraine that they're not so comfortable with. And they'd be happy to play in their own weight category, according to their perspective, namely having discussions with the West and primarily the United States. And in a way, this latest brinkmanship, in a way, is upgrading them towards that position. Of course, from Russian perspective, when it comes to the formal talks, they would very much like Ukraine to deal bilaterally with the Eastern separatist republics. So again, this matter of perception of who are the key players, who should be talking to one another, is important, and it has implications also on what are the core issues. Are you looking at really only the crisis in Eastern Ukraine, or are you bringing into broader question of security in Europe?
Well, it's really interesting as you describe it there, because there are so many different facets, but it's like Russia wants to see Ukraine as its internal crisis, so to speak, that they have nothing to do with, and then they have their own concerns. I mean, just on their own concerns, though, perhaps that are focused on the region, what do you expect to happen? I mean, one of the key concerns from Russia, presumably, is NATO involvement in Ukraine. Presumably, also, if there were a military invasion, perhaps NATO or the U.S. would be called to react. I mean, where do you see that whole dynamic, I suppose, going? Do you see the U.S. pulling back in some way from Ukraine going forward, or from NATO support for Ukraine? Is that what Russia wants, that would sort of end this crisis to some degree?
So regional security for Russia absolutely is key. And if you look at the formal efforts and the two Minsk protocols as well, you have this kind of a sequencing question of whether you give local autonomy first and free and fair elections in the eastern parts of Ukraine, or whether you have to have withdrawal of troops from the region first and then also give Ukraine control of its border with the eastern parts first. So it is a sequencing question. It could perhaps be solved through an international peacekeeping mission, who knows? But I think for Russia, what's become clear with the more recent events is that it's not only that Ukraine should not become a NATO member, and then this is again far into the future, even as a possible thing for Ukraine to join NATO. But that's one. They definitely want some guarantees of that not happening. But very interestingly, I think it's become publicly more explicitly recently, is that they also don't want any NATO infrastructure in Ukraine. And in that, they include also bilateral cooperation between Ukraine and NATO member states, be it Ukraine, be it Turkey, be it Poland. So again, they're becoming a bit more specific in their guarantees that they're seeking.
Well, we'll be watching tomorrow to see if any of that gets resolved in this meeting between Joe Biden and Vladimir Putin. Emily Izuau, thank you very much for joining us. That was Emily Izuau from ETH Zurich. You are listening to The Briefing on Monocle 24. You are back with The Briefing on Monocle 24. I'm Chris Chermak. Let's get the latest business news now with Bloomberg's Ewan Potts. Thanks for joining us, as always, Ewan. Let's start with more pain for investors in China's tech sector.
Chris, yes, the Hang Seng Tech Index in Hong Kong closed down 3.3% today, its biggest decline in nearly 2 months. Another big tumble in Chinese tech shares. It's not been a comfortable period for investors in the sector. Now, China's efforts to crack down on tech have been ongoing for some time. Xi Jinping has been quite clear that he thinks the tech giants have got out of control, and he wants more to be done to rein in their power. But also a lot of pressure on the US side. They're uncomfortable with a number of Chinese tech companies listed in the US. Regulators there last week deepened efforts to boot Chinese companies off the American stock exchanges. They say they're not complying with Washington's disclosure requirements. A delisting for the US stock market has quite big implications for Chinese companies. It will raise their cost of capital and reduce the investor pool open to them. A lot of this flagged up with the decision by Didi, the Chinese ride hailer, the biggest ride hailing company in China, to pull from the New York Stock Exchange just 5 months after its IPO there. That's really intensifying investor worries about the listing status of mainland firms in the US. Beijing also tightening its grip on the data-rich private sector. And we reported last week that China plans to impose more curbs on companies going public on foreign stock exchanges. China really keen that its tech firms list in China. In fact, firms right across the board list in China or Hong Kong and not overseas.
Ewan, just to follow up on that quickly, I mean, are there any investors then at this point that are bullish on China's tech sector, or are foreign investors simply going to, you know, have no choice but to pull out at this point?
Well, of course, a lot of investors are bullish on tech around the world. If you look at the US tech stocks, they've seen an incredible rally over the past couple of years or so. So Chinese shares are looking increasingly cheap compared to the rest of the world, particularly compared to America. But the Hang Seng Tech Index is now down almost 50% from its February peak. So a really quite precipitous fall. So a lot of investors will be watching out for where that bottom falls.
Absolutely. Well, and one other story, Ewan, to focus on for today, a new report on some of the supply chain problems that are facing the UK ahead of Christmas.
Yeah, supply chain log jams are taking place right around the world. They are a problem which is certainly not unique to any country. But here in the UK, we have a unique couple of effects weighing in together. COVID and Brexit creating a perfect storm of unemployment and skills shortages. An interesting report today from Logistics UK, a trade body which, as you'll guess from the title, deals in the logistics industry. 2.5 million people employed in the sector. They compared the people working in the sector in the second quarter of 2019 with the second quarter of this year, so kind of pre-pandemic and post-pandemic, in as far as we are post-pandemic, there was quite a big drop in the number of people working in the sector. Back in 2019, 14% were European Union nationals. Now only 11% were. So a lot of EU workers left during the pandemic and have not come back. There were 72,000 fewer HGV drivers, those important truck drivers are getting goods moving around the country. That was a drop of a quarter. And the number of HGV drivers from the European Union down by more than a third. There was an increase in van drivers, I guess more deliveries for all that online shopping, but a big drop off in forklift drivers. Almost a third fewer forklift drivers working in 2021 than there were in 2019. Now, the industry says it's doing stuff to fix this problem. It says it's boosting training, recruitment and pay. And interestingly, according to job search engine Adzuma, the pay for advertised salaries for forklift drivers and warehouse staff had jumped more than 8% over the last year. It's a pretty hefty increase, although the Albert does point out that the pay levels are still relatively low for these sectors, but a big, big shortage of people to get goods moving around the country.
An incredible shortage, really, and it'll be interesting to see whether even such a pay rise as 8% actually has an impact. We'll continue to follow that story, but Ewan, thank you very much for now. That was Bloomberg's Ewan Potts, and you're listening to The Briefing on Monocle 24. And finally, on today's program, it is time to get the latest news from the tech world with Monocle's very own Inspector Gadget, David Phelan, who joins us from London. David, let's start. Good to have you on the program. Let's start with Apple's Fitness Plus subscription service. It's a year old today, but you wanted to highlight a particular celebratory step they're taking.
Yes, that's right. Time to Walk is an audio exercise that you simply play it on your Apple Watch through wireless headphones. You go out for a walk, and at the same time, whoever the guest on that episode is out for a walk as well, and they talk about their lives, and they pick out three songs that are meaningful to them. It's been a very successful two seasons of Time to Walk, and today's episode is a special one. The Duke of Cambridge, Prince William, is the guest, and it's a brilliant piece of audio, and Apple is making it available for anyone to listen to. You can just go to music.apple.com today. It's on 3 times, 4 p.m. UK is the next one, listen to it. And he talks very movingly about mental health, about the importance of being mentally fit as well as physically fit, and about his mother, of course, was Princess Diana.
Of course, it's interesting to hear, as so many of us are doing so much walking over the last couple of years. Was this something you were using, David, as well? Did you find it valuable on a walk to listen to?
Yeah, absolutely. Time to Walk is, as I say, it's an Apple thing as part of Apple Fitness. Apple says that walking is the most popular workout in all the fitness workouts that they do. And so if you can listen to someone talking about their lives, whether it's someone famous like Jane Fonda or Dolly Parton or Shawn Mendes or someone you've never heard of before, it gives you an insight. And because it's just their voice and you're listening to it while they're walking and you're walking, there's something incredibly intimate. And as a result, I've often found them quite inspiring, the Time to Walk broadcasts.
It is a nice, intimate idea, but let's move on to one other one from Apple Fitness and watches to another health tracker out of Finland, a ring this time. Is it a better alternative?
Well, it's very good because it's called the Aura Ring, and the third generation has just come out, and it's very, very lightweight. I'm wearing one now. It's so light that you can effortlessly wear it when you're sleeping, whereas some other trackers, like a proper full-on smartwatch like the Apple Watch, can be a bit heavy to wear at night. But it has so many sensors in it now that it's tracking your heart rate, your temperature, and other things, so that when you wake up in the morning, it's able to tell you how deeply you slept, how much REM sleep you got, and how ready you are for the day, whether your heart rate settled early in the night or later. And it then gives you options and advice as to how hard you should be exercising the next day if you've had a less successful night's sleep than you would have liked.
Well, David, not to put you on the spot then, but I mean, do you prefer this to a watch? There are so many options for health these days to wear. Is this the better one?
Well, I'm a bit sort of more data is better. So I wear an Apple Watch, but not at night. And I wear the Oura Ring 24 hours a day. And they give you so much data, even including heart rate variability, which some scientists think can tell you that you've got COVID before you're showing symptoms or before it would show up in a test. So as they refine the analysis of that, then I think a health ring like the Oura Ring will become even more essential.
Well, finally, David, we're not always fans, it has to be said, of Amazon and e-commerce on this show, but you have found something that you think that our reading listeners might go for.
Well, we all know, especially Monocle readers know, that the paper, the printed page, is better than the electronic page. And there was some worry when Amazon first introduced its Kindle ebook readers that they would overtake people, or the amount of reading on paper would decline. In fact, the reverse has happened. And nonetheless, for going on holiday, say, or when you're traveling, then an ebook reader like the Kindle can be very good. And the latest is the Paperwhite, which has just been significantly upgraded with a very good light so that it's not too harsh on your eyes. You can adjust the warmth as well as the brightness of it. And certainly the convenience of carrying thousands of books in a very lightweight package is not to be sniffed at.
I think I can relate at least to that point. I do like a good book when I'm at home, but on travel, you prefer the Kindle as well. Is that one way to go?
Yeah, exactly.
David, thank you very much. That was Monocle's technology correspondent, David Phelan. And that is all the time we have for this edition of The Briefing. It was produced by Rhys James and Emma Searle. Our researcher was Lillian Fawcett, and our studio manager was Christy Evans. The Briefing is back tomorrow at the same time. That's 1300 in Zurich, midday in London, 7 a.m. in Washington, D.C. I'm Chris Chermak. Goodbye, and thanks for listening.